Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Romain Guy, formerly from the Android Graphics team.
And introducing the new Googler.
I'm Jake Wharton from the Android Framework team.
Wait, what?
So Jake, we need to find a name for our team, actually.
I was waiting to see what you said, yes, and I was just going to copy it.
I don't know. We're part of the bigger framework team, but we don't have a name like Chet and his UI Toolkit team.
Because I stole the name that you used to have for your team. True. So we should point out, we were just talking about Jake was the first external guest, and I guess everyone felt really awkward about that, so we had to hire him so that he could then be an internal guest instead. It's just a lot easier. You're closer to the studio, not all the badging in visitor stuff that you have to go through.
Well, we already signed all the NDA and all that stuff, so we can just talk about everything.
Yep. And then after this podcast, probably just walk into the door, and that's it. So, okay.
Been great.
So what are you going to work on at Google?
I'm here to work on Kotlin things, help improve the Kotlin developer story, which was recently announced at I.O. as being a first-party supported language.
Okay, so the language is coming from the IntelliJ folks.
JetBrains.
Yes.
That's their name. they do much more than IntelliJ. You know that, right?
I know them mostly for IntelliJ, so that's kind of how I think of them.
I think it's important to mention. I mean, they have a Python ID, a Go ID, an ID for iOS. They have a C++ one.
Ruby.
Ruby.
.NET.
They also do non-IDs.
Are they?
You know, so they do Kotlin. They have their issue tracker, UTrack. They have their code review tool called Upsource.
Are they sponsoring this show? Because if they're not, I think we should totally look into that. We'll just put this whole show on hold until we talk to them.
Fans.
In the meantime, so they have the language. They have a nice developer story out there. They go and evangelize that. So what does it mean to be working on the developer story for Kotlin from the Android team?
Well, Java's been the primary development language of choice since Android's inception. And so there's been a lot of tooling support, libraries, recommended patterns, style guides, a bunch of resources that have come out in the last 10 years now. And by introducing a new language, you essentially are almost starting from scratch. And so you have to backfill all of that content. And so that's part of it. And then just making sure that as we are recommending it as a first-party language, that as we build new things, it has equal support to from the Java side and Kotlin side, so that it feels first class and not just bolted on.
Are there things like style guides that you can depend on for some of the basics anyway? Like, so for example, for the Java programming language stuff in Android, we can say, well, there are style guides for this language. Please feel free to use those. And there are some tweaks that we have for Android specific development.
Yeah, so there is a recommended style on the Kotlin language website that gives you a starting point. There's also an effort to create a more comprehensive style guide that JetBrains is working on. But there definitely needs to be, I think there needs to be something augmenting that for Android specifically, since you have not only the Android APIs, but because it's a mobile platform and usually devices running on battery, you also want patterns that are going to be friendly to that environment. And so there's a somewhat infamous recommendations for Java, some better than others. And I think we probably want to investigate something like that for Kotlin as well.
I was going to ask, should we add the M prefix to all the properties in our style guide for Kotlin?
No. Definitely not.
And how do you feel about Kotlin and Ooms?
They're amazing.
Okay.
Even better than Java.
Actually, I haven't really used those. Are they different?
They're exactly the same.
Okay, all right. Big surprise.
Okay, then.
But yeah, overall, I think what Jack was saying is extremely important, because when we announced Kotlin, we focused a lot on the benefits of the language, and it's very expressive. You can write the same thing in Kotlin versus Java in fewer lines of code, and it's pleasant to use and all that. But it's true that supporting a new language for us is going to take much, much more than just showing people that it's a cool language. We need to... There's a lot of things that we have to do.
Well, so on the tools team, when we started writing Kotlin, so we rolled it out to everyone, like everyone can do it now. But when we did that, we pointed to the current master copy of the in-development style guide that JetBrains is coming up with, right? Because people want to know, okay, well, what are you supposed to do for formatting? Where where do the spaces go before or after colons, and what are the rules?
And what about tabs?
Well, yeah, I think everyone's in agreement, no tabs. That's not even controversial, is it? I think
no, it's not.
Only Go. Isn't Go the only language that recommends it at this point?
It only takes Chet's twisted mind to even think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, really.
I just wanted to get Tor going on
so style guide is really important. But yeah, we also had some things then where we augmented the style guide plus local recommendations for things that we've decided. But it'd be good to get those sort of rolled back.
And what's interesting with style guides, because you know, when I think about style guides, usually I just think about purely the form that the code takes, like, you know, how many spaces do you use and where do you put the spaces, that kind of stuff. But if you look at the Java style guide or the C++ style guide from Google, they go much further than that. They also talk about, you know, how you should structure the code, what kind of features you should use or avoid. So it's going to be interesting to see, particularly with Kotlin, which is a pretty feature-rich language, to figure out if there's anything that we particularly recommend, that we discourage. Just yesterday, Jake and I were talking about that kind of stuff, because I was complaining that with Kotlin, just like with many other languages that have, you know, a lot of those fun features, people, especially at the beginning, you're excited, you want to use all those cool features, and you tend to go a little overboard and replace perfectly reasonable code that's readable and easy to comprehend, and you try to make it what I call cute. So you're looking for this functional style to do the same thing, when sometimes like there's no reason to do that. And I think like the style guide could potentially express that.
Yeah, I've noticed in the latest version of IntelliJ, it's starting to suggest all these for loops to be replaced with some standalone concept that I'm not really liking the results. Well, I'm thinking that we should turn that
off. It really depends, right? I remember the same thing happened for me, at least with the Java streams.
Yeah.
You know, I started using them, and at some point I created a chain of operators on the stream that's so long, and I realized that it could be replaced with like three or four lines of for loop, and it would be much more readable.
Yeah, I was extremely happy when they added the reverse converter, yes, right? That goes from streams back to for loop, because often, especially for debugging, it's so much handier.
Yeah, definitely.
So are there elements about Kotlin which have inherently more overhead because of the things that they need to do to get it into a form that the bytecode will grok, that we would want to avoid on mobile, right? So patterns that we would recommend against?
Potentially. Yeah, I mean, like the stream example is a really good one. If you use that functional style, usually you don't want the inherent overhead that comes from that to be like the limiting factor of that code executing. And so like for this Java streams example, oftentimes you want the code to be IO bound, not CPU bound, so that the overhead inherent to the stream is not the thing that's going to be slowest. Whereas if you just have something CPU bound, like performing a computation, oftentimes the for loop is the better choice. And that holds true in Kotlin as well, which has both traditional for loops and sort of the functional style streams.
I've made that mistake myself. I once wrote for image processing a stream that was a desktop application that was manipulating bytes. It was doing something ridiculously simple, like just invert the bytes. And turns out the overhead of the streams was way, way more than the actual computation.
Well, especially there, you might end up doing autoboxing as well, right? If you're calling into these methods that are expecting objects.
Yeah, it might happen. With bytes, it's okay because you can cache them all.
And then I think the language itself offers a lot of syntactical sugar over elements that we're used to in Java. And so in Java, you might have a private field, a public getter, and a public setter, you know, a bean-style object. And in Kotlin, you would just write that as one single property. And behind the scenes, you're getting the getter and setter generated automatically in the private field. Right. And so if your internal code is always calling through the property, there might be inherent overhead of that function call when really you just want to dereference the field. And so the language itself can often hide some syntactical elements that you end up calling through, which can contribute to a little performance overhead in, you know, real tight CPU bound code like in the draw path.
Okay. I'm also concerned about, you brought up autoboxing. Are there areas where, like, this is a really elegant way to do this in Kotlin, and under the hood, it's autoboxing all over
the
place?
That's interesting, because I was about to mention something. I think, Jake, you're like me, where we like to decompile the bytecode and see what's happening in there. And I was doing that to figure out, you know, if there's autoboxing happening in some code I was writing. And I was really disappointed, because had a function taking a block or a lambda, that was taking that lambda itself was taking a float and returning a float. When I was looking at the bytecode, I realized that there was a ton of boxing and of autoboxing happening. But turns out it was extremely misleading because there was an inline function, and I was looking at the bytecode of the function itself, not of the inline copies. And the inline copies themselves were actually different. It did not have the boxing. So you have to be careful when you look even at the bytecode, because it can be misleading.
But I think the easiest way to get into autoboxing scenarios is when you make something nullable. So if you have, you know, int that could be nullable, it'll use an object then.
It also happens when you use blocks in declarations that are exposed to Java, because they need you need an interface on the Java side to be to invoke that. And in some cases, like if you have primitive types, they're exposed as the capital, you know, float, capital integer, and all that, which forces you into boxing effectively. And actually, that's one of the things too, where in Kotlin, the fact that the primitive types, there's no distinction between the boxed version and the unboxed version. On one hand, it's pretty cool because you shouldn't need to know, but I'm still uneasy about this because I want to know, like, sometimes I would love to see on my screen that I'm going to use the object and not the primitive.
I know that I think IntelliJ has a way to highlight boxed variables for you in the editor. I wonder if they could, and right now I've noticed that IntelliJ, they for some reason have decided to highlight things that are smartcasted. I don't really understand why that's helpful. I'm just, you know, I never need to know if there's a smartcast applied. Is that useful? But it seems like it could be nice for it to highlight anything where there's boxing happening that might not be obvious. That could be a really useful highlight in the editor.
We should talk to someone on the tools team about that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Are you going to work on the tools at all?
It's unclear. Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
You can if you want to.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of different areas that need exploration, and figuring out what's the highest priority, I think, is the first priority. And so tooling's definitely a big part of it, but we get a lot for free, right? We get all of the work that JetBrains has already done and that you on the tools team have already done. And so that story is actually one of the strongest ones already. And I think there's other aspects that are probably a little more important to start with.
Yeah, I think most of the presentations I've seen you do on Kotlin, you're showing these really cool DSLs. Like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could use an async task like this? And so you'll show this little helper function. Where is that helper function, right? Like, someone needs to accumulate those and publish them so that they could sort of be a known part of the Android universe. Is that something that you and your team are going to do?
I definitely think it's worth exploring. Yes. Non-committal answer.
Wow, he must have just been in Nougler training, you know, how to...
He's great. I'm proud of him already.
That's right. That's a fascinating idea. What do you think?
You'll also notice a pause before anything that Jake says. That's because the lawyer is in the room next to him advising him on what to say.
One thing I know you can do that will make Tor happy if you write more lint rules.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Jake has written lint rules in the past. Didn't you write some stuff for Timber? Or was that someone else who did it?
All of the ones in my personal projects were contributed initially, but I have updated some of them.
All right.
That might be a good segue, though, to talk about how lint now works on Kotlin, though.
Yes. I think the thing that I've said it, but I think not a lot of people have heard it, is that there's a big caveat, and that is that it doesn't work from the command line, right? So when you run Gradle lint, it is not analyzing your Kotlin code. This is a big limitation, and one we're aware of, and one we're working on. But it turns out to be very tricky, because we have to run parts of the compiler, and that compiler doesn't really want to collaborate with other parts that aren't compiling. So I'm going to be actually visiting JetBrains pretty soon, and we're going to collaborate on it. So we'll have that working. But it is true that in the IDE, all the lint checks now, every single one, are running in both Java and Kotlin equivalently. So that's pretty helpful.
As of 3.0, right?
That's right, as of 3.0.
And how did that came to be? Like,
it's magic.
More details, please. Is that a new architecture?
Worry that I've already talked about this on this podcast, so if people are bored...
Well, I did not listen to that podcast episode. I don't...
Maybe. I see. So I've told so many people, so maybe I'm not repeating it for this audience, but no, basically JetBrains did the really hard work, which is they wrote a new AST API. So at the time I was actually working on making lint use PSI, IntelliJ's own API that they use for most languages, right? And so I actually built a whole bridge from the Eclipse compiler to PSI because I couldn't run PSI outside of Android Studio.
All right. I always get them confused. The old one was PSI. The new one is ASTU.
UAST.
UAST.
Universal AST. Okay.
Well, AST universal.
And so I had hoped that Kotlin would also sort of provide a subset of PSI, so this would just kind of work. For various reasons, they are not doing that. They don't have a complete PSI. They have PSI behind the scenes, but there's different kinds, and it's not full as far as I can understand. So they built this new universal AST, which you can use, and they've implemented that both from Java and Kotlin on the, behind the scenes. In theory, you could build it for other languages too. So if you were to build one for Groovy, you know, then suddenly the same lint checks would work in Groovy. I'm not sure if that'd be worth it at this point. So that's how it works. So then they also did an initial port of most of the lint rules. Now, they were working with an old port. So I took that as an inspiration and I reported everything. So in 3.0, all the Java-based lint rules are instead analyzing UAST directly, and that's why it works on both Java and Kotlin.
So speaking of lint, one thing I always think about every time I hear you say that you've added new lint rules, do they affect performance of the IDE in any way? Like if we keep adding more and more rules...
Well, in any way, that's a pretty easy answer then, yes.
Sure, okay. But in a significant way while you're typing or...
Well, so IntelliJ is really good about sort of the threading model for the editor. There's all kinds of highlighters running asynchronously behind the scenes. And so as you're typing, it should not interfere. There's one slight problem. So back in the day, we had an issue that when you edit a layout XML files, there's a preview on the right. And to generate that preview, we'd run something called layoutlib, which runs a rendering. And that rendering wanted to call back into the XML files to figure out what are the current values. So to do that, they had to hold the read lock. So we grabbed the read lock around the entire render. When you're typing in the editor, that requires a write lock to actually insert a character. So that write lock was blocked on layout rendering. So it was laggy. So that's a problem. We've fixed that since then. And we just grab a quick snapshot of everything before we start rendering. So lint does something similar. So it shouldn't affect your typing performance, but obviously the CPU is busy. So IntelliJ has this battery saver mode that I sometimes use in meetings.
Yeah,
when my fan starts kicking in and I'm getting embarrassed that I'm obviously not listening, I'm working.
Isn't that little white, yellow cartoon dude?
Hector the Inspector.
Okay,
That's right.
I always forget.
So you click on Hector the Inspector and you get to sort of choose the level of inspections you're running. So you can, if you dial that all the way down to zero, it'll not run highlighters in the background. And that means it's not working nearly as hard. That's how you save the battery. But more importantly, your CPU is not busy, and so no one knows that you're...
We always know that you're typing instead, Tor.
Yeah, with a new clickety-clack keyboard.
You're not paying attention in the meetings. That's really the key for us. It's not your fan.
Yeah. Anyway, so you can dial back the inspections that way. But it is true that, you know, these things are compute intensive, but it's trying really hard not to be. So all of lint has been architected from the beginning to try to be fast.
Okay.
Now, what we're working on right now is a global call graph. So that's going to make the checks much more advanced, but that's going to come at a cost. Those aren't going to probably work incrementally. You probably have to do analyze inspect code and run through a full batch run, but we should be able to find much more complicated problems such as threading issues that span, you know, across classes and things like that. So
that sounds pretty
awesome.
That
will be expensive, but worth it.
Fine with me?
Yeah.
Walter was talking at a question that popped in my head for Jake, and I completely forgot now.
Yeah, no, if you just say the word lint, I'll just keep going.
Yeah, I know that.
Did you want to say anything about it in particular, or you just wanted Tor to go off for a while?
I was enjoying listening to Tor.
Okay. I mean, is there anything in particular about Kotlin lint or Kotlint that is special?
I think it just goes back to what I said about, you know, there's been this investment made historically for having these checks for Java. And, you know, you really, if you want to have this new language and have it feel like a first party supported language, you really need tools like that to be working. So,
right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, since I'm writing code in Kotlin now, I constantly keep noticing small areas where it's still lagging behind. Like I'm noticing, inline refactoring is not working in this context, things like that. So it'll probably take us a while to get the tooling to be exactly, you know, a full superset of what we have for Java.
But to be clear, it's already really, really good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not going back ever. But it's one of those things where like, we should keep investing here. We're not done.
Yes. Still trying to remember what I wanted to ask Jake.
So we could ask about the language, which is where I thought we were going to go first, which is, so we had a podcast that I'm sure you listened to many times, where we talked with Romain Yeats about, you know, their favorite elements of Kotlin. You've been working pretty deeply with it for a while. You're doing presentations about it. I guess we'd ask the same questions about you. Like, what are the things that excite you about the language, in particular about making it first-class language for Android?
There's a lot there.
Okay, what's your favorite feature? And your least favorite feature?
I can start with my least favorite.
Okay.
I'm not a huge fan of the way that implicit returns inside lambdas work. I think Java got this a lot better, where if you have a single line expression inside of a lambda, that implicitly becomes the return expression. And if you have a multi-line expression, then you explicitly have to say return. In Kotlin, just the last expression inside of a block that's returning, a lambda that's returning, implicitly becomes the return.
Which means the last expression could be in a if, else, for instance, or...
Right. In a language that's focused on a lot of things being very explicit that were problematic in Java, that feels like one where you can accidentally introduce changes to types or returns from a block that you don't actually expect, or sometimes it even becomes ambiguous as to where a return is actually happening because of how returns work inside lambdas, which are then inside functions.
See, maybe that's an idea for a style guide. If your lambda is multiple lines, you have to use the return keyword.
No, but I think there's an issue there if you do use return. I'm trying to remember now, because I swear that someone was having a problem getting their source code compiled, and I went over like, oh, just remove the return keyword, and then they were fine.
Well, you just need a labeled return.
Maybe. Right. So yeah, a lot of times in the projects at Square that we had written in Kotlin, we would adopt a practice of doing explicit labeled returns so that you know exactly where the control flow is actually returning to. Whether it's outside of the lambda or outside of the actual enclosing function itself.
But it's true, on that topic, it can become ambiguous, especially when you're reading code that's not yours. Like when you have cross-inline lambdas that do a return, knowing what you're returning from or to can be a little bit confusing at first sometimes.
And it may be something that, going back to your thought about boxing being displayed in the IDE, it could be something that could be augmented and surfaced in the IDE so that it becomes less ambiguous in the future.
How about you draw little arrows that show you where you're returning?
Yeah, or I'm thinking, the parameter hints feature, right? Where they have a little tiny font text telling you what something is. Like maybe if the type is not obvious, they would just show the type next to the last statement or something.
It's just something that you eventually get used to it and you start to understand more. I mean, this is a new language, right? So most people have built up a history of Java where there's a bunch of things that they implicitly know that they're not thinking about because they've just seen it so many times. And so as this is a new language and we're all being exposed to it more and more, we will build up those things and it will become less of a problem. But it's just something that I notice a lot, not having built up 10 years of history with the language.
Okay, so that's your least favorite feature?
Probably.
Okay, so what's your favorite feature?
Today. Favorite's hard, yeah. It's just a language built by people that intimately know and have written a lot of Java. And so there's just so many things that are done tastefully. Probably the one that I think is the highest leverage is just extension functions. It feels like something that, it's basically just syntactic sugar around a static method. But it just makes the code read so much more, depending on how you use it, it just feels much more idiomatic to be able to add, some semantic function to a type that you don't control to make the code much more readable to the person that's, either reviewing it or later coming in to change it.
Whenever someone says just syntactic sugar, I just feel like the word just shouldn't be in that sentence. Syntactic sugar is really, really important.
Well, if you want to take it to the extreme, almost any language we've been using is just syntactic sugar on top of C and assembly. I mean, assembly was syntactic sugar.
For zeros and ones.
But it seems like a solution like this, I agree, it's a much more elegant thing. So we have this problem with the support library versus framework where like we'll have a class in the framework and then we add functionality to it in the latest release, but nobody on previous releases can get that. So we have this, view compat or app compat or whatever And then you have to know, oh, I need to call the compat version of this that has a static method that I pass an instance in, which is a completely different calling convention. So if you're used to using the framework version, you don't even know that this other thing exists or when you need to flip over. And then it's a different way of interacting with these objects, right? And everybody's getting used to this, but I think it's really painful and unobvious from the outside when you're starting. Whereas something like this, you could just add this extension function or utility package, and then you just keep calling this thing in the same way, right?
So the yes,
but
The biggest problem there is that extension functions that overload actual functions, the call site will always prefer the concrete function on the type. So if you add a method to say view, and then have an extension function which adds that method for, you know, and then calls through to the compat implementation.
Yep.
Anyone calling that method will actually call the real method on view, which is only available on, you know, API 26 or whatever, not the Kotlin extension function.
Yep.
So it's more for utility methods today, but, you know, this is something that they could change if they wanted to, and, you know, we'll see if they do.
Yeah. I mean, you also could just name them slightly, like suffix them with compat to make it clear that you're calling a compat function.
What if we use the English spelling for all of our components in the support library? You know, just throwing this out there. Everything would have an extra U. I think that's how it works. So,
and some C's would become S's.
Yeah.
So it's actually interesting. Let's say we provided a bunch of extension methods for Vue, or someone does in the application or library, and someday we add the same method name to the Vue class. Your binaries will keep working, but next time you compile your application, maybe you'll silently end up calling the wrong one. So here's an idea for lint.
Well, I mean, if you have lint set up correctly, it should identify that you're calling a method added after your minimum SDK version.
Yeah.
If you accidentally resolve to the real method.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Should just work.
Yeah. But it's something worth exploring because I think that's a much better usability story, having a way to call the real function and then have it sort of transparently rewritten to the compatibility one such that you don't even have to really worry.
Something they actually have done is data classes. So, you know, a big limitation for Android developers about data classes is they're not parse level, right? So it's sort of not that helpful to begin with. But apparently, they've just, in an upcoming version of the compiler, I guess they're going to support parse level out of the box. So you make a data class, and it has the right implementation.
If you implement parse level, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think you decorate your data class with parse level, and then they insert all the other magic for you. Super handy.
And so that was the language. How about the Kotlin runtime? Are there particular APIs of the standard library that you really enjoy or that you don't? My favorite are, you know, the series of apply, let, run with all those. I love them because they're just those one-liners. When you look at the implementation, they don't do much, but they feel like something that belongs to the language itself more than the library.
I think a lot of the collections-related utilities are... It's very similar to what, you know, there's a lot in Guava for interacting with collections and, you know, partitioning or selecting the first element or just a lot of the operations that you would traditionally do on collections are now essentially built in and available as methods on that collection. And what's great is that, Kotlin doesn't have a whole separate set of collections at runtime. You're just operating on the normal lists, sets, and maps that you're used to.
That was one of the big advantages of Kotlin for us, as opposed to, you know, any other language that people might like, is the fact that the types are the same as the ones we already use on Android, and that was really big for interoperability and working with existing code.
And then because of the extension methods, they've managed to still make them much more usable.
Yes.
And I think the whole thing about list versus mutable list and set versus mutable set, the fact that you can sort of avoid the defensive copies in APIs is really, really
nice. It's not just avoiding the defensive copies because, well, you know, that was annoying. There was also like the solution of wrapping, you know, with collections dot.
Yeah.
In java.util, you can just wrap the collection in a read-only mode. But the problem is that when you see one of those, you don't know. Like, it's just declared as a list in your code. It
which is why you have to do the defensive copying, because people might think they
But even if you do a defensive copy, or even if it's wrapped in a read-only, like, I want to know, beyond documentation, what it's meant to be. Like, yeah, so even if you made a copy, if I'm not supposed to put something in it, like if I start putting things in it, I might be surprised that it doesn't do anything because it's not clear that that was not the intention.
Yeah.
Or you can do it the Android way. In a lot of our APIs, we don't do a defensive copy, we don't wrap it, and we just trust that you're not going to mess with it.
Yeah. So, Jake, so you've been on the, you know, outside of the Android and Google teams for a long time, and, you know, you've been able to point fingers.
How does it feel to be the culprit
now? What's it going to be like to sort of see the world from the other side?
I don't know. This is basically the first meeting I've had at Google. It's my third day.
Yeah, so all meetings are in front of microphones and studios at Google. This is how we, that's wondering. How we make sure we have a...
All the rooms are decorated.
A record. Notes, like a record, yeah.
It was actually part of the appeal, right? Is that, you know, now I am one of the ones held accountable. Mm-hmm. But it also means that there's a potential for greater impact as well, to be able to provide these things and fix these things. And so that I'm looking forward to it.
You can fix anything you want.
Sounds good. Assign all bugs to Jake. All right. Done. All right. So I'm curious, speaking of coming in from outside, what the state of the things you were working on is. So you had like various open source libraries in flight or that you've been maintaining over the years. So that was the essence of the first show that we had you on years ago now, sort of talking about ActionBar Sherlock and all that stuff. So that's gone, probably.
That one's gone, thankfully, yes.
But you found it in...
I did find it in Google 3 yesterday.
I'm sure you did. There are a lot of applications that write the code and then move on.
Yep.
So what's the state of, what were you working on over there, externally?
Over there. A lot. Square has been really lucky, actually, to have a bunch of people and to have the opportunity to work on some really great open source work. And none of that stuff has really stopped. There's a focus around databases that we were doing. So we have a competitor. We wrote a version of a database abstraction, which is shockingly similar to Room, where, you know, elevates SQL to be a very first class citizen instead of trying to abstract away the database. And we had been working on reactive layers on top of the database so that your queries automatically update whenever the database changes, which is, again, very similar to Room. And what came out of that actually is it does, you know, Java code generation to fulfill, create types that you can interact with that abstract away the database. And what we found is that actually from using it from the Kotlin side, it actually didn't feel very idiomatic. And about 6 months ago now, we started a project to do Kotlin code generation. So we had a product called Java Poet, which allows you to generate Java code in a fairly clean way used by libraries like Dagger. And so now we have a Kotlin Poet that is being worked on, which actually just had a release yesterday, which is allowing you to generate Kotlin code. So whether you have a command line tool, an IDE tool, or potentially even a compiler plugin for Kotlin, or even, I guess, an annotation processor running in Kotlin, the Kotlin compiler, you can generate Kotlin code similar to, you know, how Dagger generates Java code. And so that's something that's still being worked on. And then you have kind of the networking suite of libraries, which is OKHTP, Retrofit. And those are still undergoing, you know, active development. And in the future, we're looking to make all of those things essentially work better from the Kotlin side. So those are still, you know, just because I left Square, I still have a strong relationship with the team there. And so
saying there are other committers, basically.
Yeah. Okay. I am now an external contributor, but I, you know, remain committed to the future of these libraries because actually they're used inside Google as well. So I guess technically...
Don't we use OKHTTP on Android? I think we do it somewhere in the source tree.
Yeah, OKHTTP is the implementation that backs HTTP URL connection.
There you go.
For the entire Android platform.
Nice.
So that definitely can't go anywhere and will continue to be worked on.
And OKHTTP uses OKIO, right?
Right, which is a what we think is a more thoughtful I/O abstraction versus Java I/O.
I gotta say, I used OKIO when I was working a little bit on tools, and it was a really good API for I/O stuff. Very nice.
So that OKIO permeates our whole Square's whole like networking offerings. So it's in using OKHTP, which is where it was born. It's exposed in Retrofit, and then there's two libraries, Wire and Mashi, which are serialization libraries, one for protocol buffers and one for JSON. And it's also used in those as well. And so since they all use OKIO, they basically can benefit from not having to copy bytes around. They can just sort of move them, which is very similar to, you know, how Kotlin, what we were just talking about with list and mutable list, because you share these abstractions, you don't have to always be doing defensive copies at every layer.
Square has always been unique to me because it seems like the company, from the outside, it seems like it exists to produce these amazing open source libraries. Like there are other companies in the world that produce open source libraries, but it seems like that was more ingrained at Square, that a lot of the work that was done resulted in open source libraries for whatever reason, you know, just the people that were collected there, a concerted effort by management. I'm not sure what, but it's very nice.
I'm sure it's a great way to attract talent.
Yes, that is something I've heard. It's, you know, a recruiting tool, because then you get the interest of people that actually want to pursue that, which is fantastic. My main concern in your coming to Google is that we're actually going to see less code from you for Android now than we did before, because you're not contributing to these, you know, open source projects. So that's too bad.
You know, Android's an open source project, right?
Oh, right. Right. Except he's going to be in meetings all day. That's what I heard.
Meetings with microphones.
Yeah.
Watch out if you stop scheduling meetings all the time.
Yeah, you could help.
If I don't schedule meetings, what meaning has my life?
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll see though. But to your point, I think it's just something that was in the Android culture at Square from very early on.
Oh, was it specifically Android?
It's not to say that there isn't, you know, open source projects from other teams, but I think, or other platforms, I should say, but from the Android team, from very early on, the culture was just, you know, being able to share as much as possible.
I mean,
because
some of the early employees, like Bob Lee, who came from Google, and Bob worked on Android, and he was, you know, active in the open source community, and I think that definitely helped.
Yeah, I mean,
build that culture.
Yeah, Bob was definitely had a huge impact on it, and even when Jesse Wilson came from Google to Square, you know, he had worked on a bunch of open source stuff here at Google as well, and so it just became something that was the norm, not an exception.
Yep.
If you build something that's applicable to more than the product yourself, why not make it a library? And if you're going to, you know, make it an internal library, why not go a little bit farther and just put it in the open for others to use?
I can also imagine that going through the effort of open sourcing publicly those libraries kind of ensures that you're going to raise the quality even higher, because you're going to think about the APIs even more, about documentation, Stargate, whatever, right? But it becomes much more important to make all the things good as opposed to when it's just an internal tool that
difference.
People already know because they work on it.
You just don't take shortcuts on certain things.
Fewer shortcuts, maybe.
Yeah, fewer.
The difference between a diary and a book. Right? Are you writing it for yourself or are you writing it for an audience?
Well,
I got nothing else. We talked about Kotlin. We talked about open source libraries. Anything else you want to talk about? State of Android?
Yeah, I remember the question I had for Jake. So, you know, one of the things that we've been looking into with Kotlin is the ability to compile your Kotlin code to other backends, so, you know, JavaScript, native. Is that something that you've used already, or that you were just, like us, you were thinking about it? And
So you have the ability to write common Kotlin code, which doesn't have any platform dependencies, and then have it compiled to Java bytecode, JavaScript, and then potentially down to native code, either for a desktop or potential competing mobile platform. It's really interesting. It's really early, at least for the native stuff. JavaScript a little more fleshed out. I have looked into it. I actually gave a talk 2 weeks ago now about a kind of theoretical app and how you would build it in this multi-platform way. I definitely think it's something that should be explored. It's not ready yet. Both from the side of, you know, the native side, it's really, really early. Mm-hmm. But just how you architect things is, you know, unexplored, and some of the tooling is not really where it needs to be yet. But I think it has a strong future. And it's definitely something that we should be keeping an eye on.
We can just auto-convert the framework to Kotlin and then just recompile it in JavaScript, and then we can run Android in the browser.
Yes, that's all we have to.
You're not supposed to talk about our secret future strategy.
So you drew a book. One of the early prototypes of Android was in JavaScript.
Yeah, who did we talk to? But that seems like an episode.
Ficus.
Ficus.
Andy Fadden. Yeah, because when I joined in 2007, I saw like, and I don't know if the idea was to, you know, build it that way, or if it was just a way for them to like try out a few APIs and architecture ideas. But you know, that was interesting back then.
Good old days.
Good old days.
Yeah, I feel like now with this Kotlin support, it's sort of like a reboot of a lot of, you know, a lot of APIs and static tooling and all that. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, it does give us, you know, of course, we always worry about compatibility, and we want to ensure a great continued experience compared to what people already have. But it's a nice place for us to try to, and we can try to reimagine some things, and maybe we won't, right? But it's a good opportunity, it's a good reason to try to think about, you know, some of our APIs differently or some of the tools.
Yeah, there's some new APIs, and there's also sort of the existing ones, you know, of us starting to become more formal about things like, can this be null or not null, and things like that.
And it will probably inform like new APIs, especially anything that's, you know, in the support libraries or that kind of projects.
Right. Certainly, if we can make a more elegant experience for developers, we should.
Right. So do you have any plans whether you're going to have value add Kotlin libraries on top of the existing support libraries, or if there's patterns that we're just going to adopt for Java that work better for Kotlin?
I can't talk about future plans.
All right.
That was just a test.
Yeah, from the best.
I don't know.
I think yes to both. I mean, something for instance that we very much want to do. So we have an API console internally. So every API, you know, goes through discussions and is vetted. And we definitely want to think about those APIs from now on in the context of this world that has Kotlin. That means that most APIs, I'm sure, we won't change because of Kotlin. But maybe in some very few instances, we'll change the API slightly to make sure that it's good both on the Java side and for Kotlin users.
A really good example there is, you know, any function that takes an argument and then a type that can be rendered as a lambda. And so you don't want the type rendered as a lambda to be the first parameter.
Yeah, you want it last.
Because in Kotlin, there's a syntax where you can just specify the non-lambda type, close the parentheses, and then use a curly brace to open the last parameter, which is the lambda, which it's a very subtle thing. It's just the ordering of a parameter, which doesn't seem like it's that important, because in Java, it's, you know, the syntax is the same either way. But that's something where if you think about that ahead of time for how you're going to be consuming it in Kotlin, you would want the order to be such that the lambda comes last.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Now, that's something we're struggling with now. We have a code base that's mixed Java and Kotlin.
In
the tools, yes. And so, you know, Kotlin has a very good story for dealing with single methods in interfaces, right? SAM methods. So you can just pass a lambda to it. It works beautifully. But if you were to try to define that interface in Kotlin, it does not work. Right, because the Kotlin guidelines say no, you're supposed to use a function instead. Don't use an interface. So they deliberately don't support the same SAM conversion that they have for Java from Kotlin. So if you want to write your code in Kotlin, but you still think that some Java code could digest it, you have a problem now, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, there's an issue for that, and I believe that they're going to walk that back and actually allow SAM conversion for Kotlin-defined types.
I feel like since the first day I've heard of Kotlin, this has been part of the discussions around Kotlin.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where if you want to write your code in Kotlin, but you still have Java,
of course,
you know, clients, it's a little unfortunate.
If you don't care about what type is actually exposed from the Java side, like if you don't want Java util function or Java util, you know, consumer or supplier, you actually can use a type alias there, which will allow the type that you see from the Java side to be a named single abstract method interface. But from Kotlin, you still get the, you know, function syntax, the lambda syntax.
Oh.
So that will work as long as you don't care that, you know, from Java, it's not a runnable, it's just a...
So, yeah, and what you mentioned is earlier I was talking about boxing, and that's where you can run into boxing issues, because your blocks in Kotlin, your lambdas, will be turned into one of those java.util.function that take generics, and right. that would become a capital float or capital integer. And you get boxing, and whereas on the Kotlin side, it's not necessarily boxed because it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, just inline stuff.
So that could be solved for, like, you know, if there were, for instance, common patterns where 90% of the time those functions are take an int, return an int, take a float, return a float, we could have specializations for those particular SAMs and maybe generate better code. But anyway, things to think about.
Yeah, there was a survey that Kotlin team did a while back asking people to basically rate their wish list. And I think SAM conversion was like, I think it was number one. Or number two, one of them, I think. So, you know, assuming that they attack these problems in order, you know, this might get done.
Yeah, there were some pretty cool features in that list, I remember.
On the other hand, you know, you don't want to do language design as a democratic process.
Of course. No, but it's good to be informed by, like, maybe priorities. Like, if you already know what you want to do, just about, like, which one first.
Yeah. I mean, I think, for example, if they were to propose adding static back to the language, I think a lot of people would vote for that, but it'd probably be the wrong thing to do at this point.
I wish I could remember like the list of, because there were about 20 features, so a few of them that they really, really wanted.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
We'll see.
Do you have
Kotlin is young.
Do you have a wish list of things that you would like Kotlin to do?
Most of them were encapsulated on that list. I think the value classes one.
Yes,
which
please.
Is basically
makes a case for value classes.
It's an okay, so you have colors in Android represented as ints.
Or longs now.
Or longs.
Or short int, or what is that?
The long ones are probably a lot better to talk about because in order to decompose those, you need to grab, you know, four sets of 16 bits.
Right.
And what you really want is just to be able to have an abstraction on that color that you call a method on saying, you know, get red or get green or get alpha. But you don't want that abstraction to require a box, you know, a class that's wrapping the long. And so a value class is an abstraction without overhead. It allows you to, in the type system, represent it as a color, but in the bytecode, it's still represented as a long. And because it's represented as a class in the language, you get all the benefits of a class, theoretically implementing interfaces, and then having methods or even extension methods on top of them for, in this example, to, you know, decompose that long into.
So behind the scenes, it would just call a bunch of methods passing in the int.
Right. It's same as an extension function, but now it's like an extension class almost.
To use a poor analogy, think of C or C++ structs where the struct is just the types that it contains. There's no extra overhead that you get typically with classes. Because, you know, in a typical Java class, you have there's a few bytes that are there just for the runtime or for some of the built-in functions.
It's been a long time since I didn't see, but with struct, you still would go and allocate an actual struct, right? Whereas here we're talking about simply, this is syntactic sugar where the compiler pretends that you have an instance, but really you don't.
Well, you have an instance.
Like the int is
the underlying, type.
But okay.
No, there's a key, for instance, in C or C++, if you have an int, you can cast it to a struct that contains an int, like the memory layout just have to match. But anyway, that was
like
a poor analogy, but you know, really that's why it would be extremely helpful for a number of reasons.
Yeah, it seems particularly for mobile.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Just another example that is a pain point from Android is ints are used as a replacement for enums that are choices, and ints are also used to abstract flags instead of a bunch of booleans.
Yeah.
So imagine if instead of having an int that had a bunch of bits set for flags, you had a abstraction that was a class which had you know, functions that return booleans or even properties, immutable properties that return booleans that would basically just look up the correct bit or potentially even set the right bit, and then you get this higher level API that you can interact with instead of having to do the underlying bit manipulation.
So for their particular implementation, are they thinking of having just a single value underneath, or could it be, for instance, you know, the example of a rect or a point where you really want two ints?
I think without something like value types in the JVM, you're restricted to only having a single primitive.
So value type, that's what I was asking. Value type is an extension of that where you could finally create, for instance, ideally an array of rectangles, but instead of having currently when you create an array of rectangles, you get an array of references to rectangles. In this case, you could create an array where all the rectangles live in the array. So you have this linear location because they're just like primitive types underneath. And
yeah.
The class is just
this
there.
Sounds very useful, especially for Android.
Yeah, and it would be very useful for a lot of like high performance use cases where it's still worth it going down to native code today. When there's no reason we should, like, it's just a limitation of really the language and the type system.
Yeah.
I like the bit flags thing. That would improve Vue.java infinitely. The number of times
we
deref those.
How many ints do we have right now? We're at private flags number 3 or number 4?
It was right on the border of 4. I don't know if we've, yeah.
Yeah, so we have this field called mprivate flags that, you know, contain each bit means something inside Vue for state.
And, yeah, and you have like 4 of them. Flags 1, flags 2.
Yep.
Flags 3, flags 4.
Yeah, so that's 128 flags.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the setting it and checking it is just, it creates all this nasty code all over the place.
And making
it's
sure
not
that when
unique.
You add
it's
one,
not like there's
overlap.
One bit per flag, right? There's overlapping meanings too, I think, right?
Overlapping. Well, there are some states like visibility takes up a couple of them, right?
Yeah.
Because it has
yeah,
a tri-state.
Some of them use multiple bits.
Yep. Yeah, it's a mess. And we have run into overlaps before where like some flags clobbered others because there's not really a good way in the language itself to represent this. Instead, you're just doing bit manipulation, which is really easy to mess up.
Well, there are classes you can use a bit set or enum set or something. Yeah. It's really all heavier.
Anyway.
Any other feature that was in that list that's worth mentioning?
Well, instead of that, I don't know if this was in the list or not, but something that's new that they're actively working on is the coroutines.
Yes.
Which I think is worth mentioning, especially for Android, where everything, you know, you can't get away without asynchrony in writing a modern Android app. It's just impossible. And so then you're subject to, you know, all the pitfalls of concurrent programming. And so coroutines are a effort in the language and the libraries of Kotlin to provide a better interface to concurrent programming, to writing things that are asynchronous. So instead of having to do, you know, what we would traditionally do, something like callbacks or maybe an observer pattern or listeners, it allows you to write, you know, linear imperative code that operates asynchronously, but you don't have to program it in that fashion.
It's asynchronous synchronous code or synchronous asynchronous code.
Yeah.
It takes a little while to get your head wrapped around that concept. I mean, it's not new. Like, there are other languages who've done that before. And it's often associated with, you know, we are having the discussions. There are variants or cousins like fibers or generators, like if you use Python or other languages that have those methods that can yield and can be basically parsed. So you can do a lot of very interesting things.
And the most interesting thing, I think, for Android is that this functionality in the language is very tiny. Yeah. Most languages implementing this put in a full async await solution into the language itself. So C#, you have, you know, the async and await keywords. In Kotlin, the primitives in the language are very few. They really just have the ability to mark a function as suspend, and then there's, I think, only 2 methods in the actual standard library itself that support this feature. And then everything else is built on top of that as a library. And so you can have async await, you can have, you know, generators that yield functions, you can have channels, actors, you can have, you know, all these concurrency primitives that other platforms have or that require really heavyweight abstractions to implement on, you know, a bytecode-based language. They can do it in a much lower overhead way. And that allows you then to potentially write something specific for Android, or even baked into something like a explicit support library for Android. I mean, the coroutine support that they have has some Android support for knowing about things like the main thread. But because the whole thing isn't banked into the language, you have the opportunity to come up with something very idiomatic that just operates as a library. So that's something worth exploring, I think.
Yeah, and that's the part that's powerful about the way they are going about it. Like you said, you don't have just the async and await keyword. You can build, they give you the tools to build your own. And since I realized that, you know, I haven't had great ideas, but I'm wondering if for Android, like, what could we come up with that would be useful that goes beyond what they have in the standard library? So definitely something worth exploring.
And on that note, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.